All right. So, I think as a good opener, I think we really get great insight when we discover a paradox. When everything seems to make sense, then we're stuck because everything makes sense. When we become aware of, oh my God, this is a real contradiction, then in the grappling with the contradiction that will never have a resolution, we open up a portal to something that without the paradox, we never would have seen. And the paradox that I would like to focus on, and I'm going to use, I can even say Lubavitcher terms or Lubavitcher slogans, and I wish I had more universal slogans. So for people who are listening, I'll do my best to explain what the following statement means. There is an attitude which is very attractive and it's very inspiring called Lechatchila Ariber. Lechatchila Ariber is a statement, is a phrase that the fourth Rebbe used a lot. The Rebbe definitely quoted this statement of his a lot. The entirety of that statement, it's almost like a mission statement of how to be. And the statement is that in the world, or others say, that when you encounter an obstacle, try to work with it. And if you can't work with it, then just overcome it. And I say, that Rebbe Arash says, lechatchila, from the outset, go over it. There is a way in life of just jumping over obstacles. There is like the think big attitude, big picture attitude, that when you adopt that, you are able to overcome a lot. Because you have this lechatchila ariber deka attitude. Lechatchila ariber is very gutsy. It's very courageous. Courageous doesn't mean I don't feel fear. Courageous means, okay, I feel fear, but now what? Now I'm going to do what I need to do and I'm going to go big. You have this non-Jewish statement, go big or go home or something like that. That's lechatchila ariber. And I'm sure there are many other expressions of it, and I'll share some more with the story. And then there is the opposite attitude. The opposite attitude is that easy does it. In the Holy Tongue, the expression is ma'at ma'at agor Hashenu, a bit and a bit, slowly but surely, will be able to expel the evil. Implying that you can't have the big picture, you can't lechatchila ariber, you can't just overcome it if you don't go through it. If you want to get over something, you have to go through something. And going through something is a process, and it's a step by step by step by step, and it's very orderly. When it comes to acquiring wisdom, for example, you can't lechatchila ariber that. I'm becoming a doctor tomorrow. No, you're not. Because the type of learning you have to do, the type of knowledge you have to acquire, even if it's only in your mind, at least just to know the information, is a lot. And there's only that much you can do every day, a little bit today, a little bit tomorrow, a little bit, and then you accumulate, and there is growth by accumulation. It's like in life, some people walk through life, some people run through life. Walking would be step at a time, step at a time. When you're running, when you're leaping through life. Many people have businesses. Their attitude is lechatchila ariber. However they do that, right away they have this big thing happening before anything is happening. And then there are people that say, no, 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 that's crazy. You don't know what you're doing. And the guy says, so what? I'm going to do it anyways. Lechatchila ariber. And one attitude is, no, 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 a step at a time. There's no doubt that we need to have both of these attitudes in life. And I think the more we appreciate how opposites they are, the more we'll be living with a dilemma, which is the goal. The goal is to feel the dilemma. The goal of the dilemma is, which one is the right thing? What attitude should I take? Let me share with you a beautiful Lubavitcher story. And the story I'm sharing, Davke, in preparation to Yud Shvat, which is this Shabbos. I know we're going to have a woman's Fabrengen Wednesday night. I'll find another story. I just read the story, and it's very inspiring, even if you're not familiar with the names. But some of us here or listening to it will be familiar with some of the names of the events. A little bit of background over here. That the Soviet Union, communism, became a thing. They began in 1917. You can say that's when their revolution began. In 1920, they were established. And it was very difficult for our grandparents to be Jewish, to behave Jewishly. As bad as it was in the beginning, and for the previous Rebbe, he was arrested, and he was going to be executed, and he was tortured. That was in 1927. So the challenge began from the beginning. It began in 1920, and it got worse and worse. Yet, there was a huge difference between the 1930s and the 1940s. In the 1930s, when we got arrested, almost all of us were not killed. And some of us were dealt with very harshly, just because we were frum. 3 years, gulag. Not 10 years. It's a huge difference. Not that 3 years is good. There was some sort of, I'm just repeating words that I heard from Russians. This is not from Rebbes. That in the 30s, if you were not externally very Jewish, even if they knew that your house is Shabbos and you're keeping kosher, they let you be. They didn't want it to spread. They looked at it as mamash like a disease. But if you're keeping it at home, there was a certain level of tolerance. In the 1940s, things changed horribly. This is under the same Stalin, but the cruelty became horrible. And mamash, listen, many of us got killed. Many of us suffered terribly. Many of families, both parents were sent away, both parents. So all the kids purposefully were given away to adoption by Goyish homes. And the Friedrich Rebbe left, the Friedrich Rebbe left in 1929, but he came to America in 1940. America and Russia are, right, the Cold War. And every single correspondence that went back and forth was looked over by what we call the KGB. They called it then the NKVD. It was called the KGB. It was horrible. It was really horrible. And at some point in the 1940s, the Hasidim understood that all of us that are frum, let's begin with the men. We had beards. You can't hide that. You can put on this hat and that hat. You grew a beard. In that culture then, who grew a beard? A frum yid. So you're marked. So they know that you're Jewish. A frumah person was told that you're going to be taken away, you're going to be killed, you're going to be sent in gulag. And what's the alternative? The alternative is to try to run away from Russia. It was not an easy task to run away from Russia. There was a lot of risk involved. In the 1940s, after the Second World War, being that many Polish soldiers, they sided with Russia against Hitler, and many of them were in Russian territory. So after the war, even though there was an Iron Curtain, if you were Russian, you couldn't get permission to leave just because you wanted to leave. But if you would present a Polish passport, then they would let you go to Poland. And that was the path people went from Russia. They went to Lviv. And then once you were in Poland, somehow they managed to get to Germany. And once you got to Germany, now you had these DP camps. And that was the path of all of the Hasidim. The Friedrich Rebbe would tell some people to go to the Holy Land, some people to France, I don't know why, and some people to America. I mean, the Friedrich Rebbe mamash directed Hasidim where to go. Now, Russian soldiers were killed. There were forgers with the Polish passports. From our greatest Hasidim, they were master forgers. So either Polacks died and we bought their passports, just exchanged the pictures, or outright fabricating passports and in mass. So and people are leaving with men, women, children. They barely speak Russian, these Hasidim. Forget about Polish. Presenting themselves as there was a lot of danger involved. And no Hasid would make a move, which if you're caught, I mean, you can be killed. You can be sentenced. You can lose your kids. They wanted Rebbe's opinion. No one was able to write to the Rebbe directly. The letters would never make it to him, and his response will never make it back. we can say this is the old secrets that now is no longer secretive. It was from the most prominent ways of getting to the previous Rebbe was at that time, there was a chassid that's really renowned today, Binyamin Gorodetsky of blessed memory. I don't know if you remember him. I mean, I grew up in the 80s. I remember him as an elder. Binyamin Gorodetsky was the son-in-law of Shmuel Levitin. Shmuel Levitin was the spiritual leader of the yeshiva in Lubavitch. Shmuel Levitin, one of his children became the head shluchim in Seattle. I'm saying, you guys know already his great-grandchildren. I know my brother, I have a brother called Shmuel, because my father, who got there in 1947, was so enamored. When you have a bad teacher, it's horrible. When you have a great teacher, halavai, our kids should have good teachers. He was so, this is a side of the Rebbe. Imagine, to name your kid after his teacher. Shmuel Levitin was an extraordinary. He came already as a widower. He decided never to get remarried. He moved into 770. He slept in the library to be dedicated to the Bachram 24/7. He was a very special Jew. Binyamin Gorodetsky, son-in-law, wrote letters to his father-in-law. That was acceptable. Rab Shmuel was in New York. Binyamin was in Russia. Rab Shmuel would ask the Friedrich Rebbe whatever the question was, and he would answer, and then critically he would write a letter back to Binyamin, and Binyamin would share it with the Hasidim. That was the path. This question was whether we should risk our lives attempting to escape Russia with falsified documents. They didn't have to write all of this, or stay put with the risk of us getting arrested. Some of us get killed. Now we know what the Friedrich Rebbe really answered. Whatever he answered then was so cryptic that the Hasidim did not understand what he said. Things got from bad to a lot worse. I think it was 45 or 46. The Friedrich Rebbe, we know now, first responded to stay. It's too risky to leave. And a few months later, he wrote again that whoever doesn't have small children, see, the small children really went against your Polish soldier with kids, with young kids. Like, it was so, even though when you came with your wife, they knew that you're lying, but they bribed everyone. But there's that much you can bribe for. So the Friedrich Rebbe actually responded that the families without young children should make the risk. Families with young children should not risk. That was his response. No one knew what he responded. So what are you going to do? This is Lubavitcher history. So they made a Beis Din of 23 people. Just to know that in Jewish law, a Beis Din is three. You know when you have a Beis Din of 23? You have a Beis Din of three, huh? No, but why do you have that number? Whenever the Beis Din is giving a judgment on life and death, it has to be at least 23 judges. So the Hasidim felt it was mamish life and death.
So it's not unanimous.
They'll never be unanimous. Right. We want to have an odd number. All but the dinim, not all. The rule, there's three. There's a Beis Din of five. I know there's a Beis Din of 10, but that's the exception. 23, 71. We're looking for an odd number, knowing that everyone will have a different opinion and you follow the majority. That's the general rule. There was a great chassid by the name of Nissen Nemenov, Rab Nissen. He said that tzaddikim of a Lubavitcher community. Rab Nissen became the mashpia in Brinois. Rab Nissen was such a giant, now that we're one day away from the yahrzeit of the Baba Sali, that for many years, the great tzaddik, the Baba Sali, the leader of the Sephardic Jews, he would go Elul and spend it by Rab Nissen to learn, to be in Rab Nissen's environment. Rab Nissen was from a different type of a person. Rab Nissen was one of the 23. There was a Jew by the name of Haikal Chanan. I don't know if you know his grandkids. So he has a son called Zalman Chanan. And Zalman Chanan is my father's age, so maybe you know his grandkids. Zalman, he should be Liva. By now he's probably in his 80s. He's not. You know, on Montgomery. I don't know, you're from Crown Heights? No. Okay. Haikal Chanan was from the very few wealthy Lubavitcher Hasidim. There were wealthy Lubavitcher families, like there were many poor families, but when the communists took over, they stole everyone's wealth. And my mother's grandfather, Meir Simcha Chen, was wealthy. They took everything away from him. He had factories, and my mother remembers, in memories, that either her mother or one of her uncles were telling her that Tata, that him, Meir Simcha, imagine you're a millionaire, and next day you have nothing. So he locked himself in his room. So they were curious to see what he's doing. And she looked through the keyhole and she saw her father or his father pacing back and forth and talking to God. They took away my money. Okay, but don't let them take away my mind. Don't let them take away my faith. Don't let them take away my heart. Like he was struggling with loss. It's hard to lose. He was facing it. But we lost everything. This Hanan guy, I don't know how he did it. He kept his wealth. Everything was black market. That means he was a very shrewd, with God's mazel. He was a very wealthy chassid. It was like almost impossible to be wealthy. He was the supporter of the yeshiva, of the Rebbe. And he was a Jew that he didn't accumulate wealth for his pocket. He was like one of the pillars who was supporting the whole thing. He was one of the 23. Just to give you, so there was holy tzaddikim. There were communal activists, and they got together, and there was a debate. The minority felt, got to get out. The majority said it's too risky to leave Russia. We're staying here. You got to follow the majority. Somewhere in 1946, I don't know how much after this gathering, this Hanan of blessed memory, he needed a surgery. Yeah, and Russians, they had hospitals. They think they have good doctors. Could be they have good doctors. I don't know their thing. So he was already, they say, in his gown, basically before the surgery, you get ready. The patient, he was already dressed for the surgery. And someone told him that the KGB, they have your name. They know that you're here. And they're coming here, they're going to get you. You have to leave. You have to leave. So he called his wife and he says, we're leaving Russia, not leaving the hospital. I know there was a ruling, and in respect to Rav Nissen, who was part of that group, I have to let him know that I'm breaking it. He felt he has to leave. So he went to Rav Nissen. He told Rav Nissen, this is what happened. They're coming after me. I am leaving Russia. Rav Nissen says, if you're leaving Russia, I'm also going to break the Beis Din. That broke it. I'm also leaving. By the way, that broke the whole thing. Many hundreds of families left because of this. They decided to leave. Now, these Rav Nissen and Hanan, their pictures were with the KGB. How are you leaving? So they had these passports. First of all, Haikal Hanan left 1 million ruble. I don't know what that means. He left 1 million ruble for the Lubavitcher Bachram, and he was very wealthy. And the rest of his wealth he left with two Hasidim, Mendel Futifas, and with a woman that we call Muma Sara, Aunt Sara. Muma Sara, the end of the story was they shot her in front of her son. They murdered her. My brother married Muma Sara's granddaughter. These Lubavitcher families. Now Mendel Futifas and Muma Sara, just to know what they did. They took all of this money, they took the 1 million ruble, and they used it to get passports to all the Bachrim. They weren't supporting the yeshiva. Everyone left. Then they decided unanimously that all of his wealth, they're not going to get it to him in France. They're going to use it to forge passports to get everyone out. And God is going to have to forgive them. So this Jew, I don't know how he remade it. He made it again, this guy. But the Fidei Rebbe wrote letters to the guys in America about how everyone is obligated to help him. They took his wealth against his will, but it was life or death. It was Mesiras Nefesh. Muma Sara knew they're going to get her. Mendel Futifas knew they're going to get him. These were the big forgers. They had passports. They gave their passports to other Hasidim. And she was murdered, and he went 10 years in slave labor. These were giants of people. Anyways, now they're leaving. So they're leaving. How do you leave? What do you do? Should you take the train? Should you take the road? Take a bus? They're looking. The police stop. They go in and they look at you. And they're going to have a picture of him. I'm giving just a mashal of lachatchila ribir. You know what they did? There were airplanes then in Russia that were only used by government officials and by people that were very, very wealthy. Were Americans that would come, foreigners that would come. No one used the flying in Russia. No one had money for it. They're flying. They went to the airport. In other words, everyone is looking for them, but it was such a lechatchila river they could move. They took a plane and they pushed it. They flew out of Russia.
How did they know how to fly?
They had money. What do you mean?
Oh, so they hired
They bought tickets. They had false documents, but they went on a route that you got to think big to go on that route. When people are running away, they're going only at night, and they're going only in this train that goes from this village to that village. They went in front of everyone like wealthy people. And it worked. I'm just saying that lechatchila, they say that when they flew out, first of all Truma Jews that left Russia then, no one touched their beard, but it gives away that you're Jewish. Only Truma people wanted.
Why would they touch their beard?
Huh?
They were licensed.
They did not touch their beards. When I'm a serious nefesh, my say that they bandaged their faces. That's the way they left Russia. All of the Lubavitcher families, because they were coming out that they were Russian. They were Polish soldiers. People get wounded during the war, bandaged up. It also helps you camouflage your face because they had pictures of the Hasidim.
Such an extreme thing, like lie on like the beard, Mr. Snackish. Like there's so many. It is, but think about it, like the Sephardim or whatever. It's not even a thing, beard. Like why is it a thing?
Right.
I think I would say like this. That's a good question. There are different ways of looking at any given mitzvah. When it comes to looking at mitzvahs, there are only three mitzvahs for which we have to die, right? Adultery, idolatry, and murder.
Right.
Other than that, we're actually obligated to violate the commandment, but there are mitzvahs that represent the whole of Judaism.
But it's kind of like dafka, like I don't know.
One second. And I would say that for a man, right now, meaning in 2025, and Topshin Pehei, the culture, at least here, the Western culture is not anti for a man. It doesn't negate people wearing beards. Many people from different groups have beards. When I grew up in the 80s, no one wore a beard. It was unheard of. So wearing a beard was a very demonstrative way of showing everyone that I'm Jewish, that I'm observant. And I think it's more than that, at least now. I don't know how it was then. A big part of the Western culture exaggerates the importance of the external, exaggerates. And in other words, it's beautiful to be beautiful, no question about it. The question is, what's beautiful, and how beautiful is it to be beautiful? Okay, so you're beautiful. So this, when I was in yeshiva in 1980s, it was a big deal for a bacher not to touch his beard. It was a big deal.
Also
now,
yeah.
I see now I'm a little bit older. Let me say this. Okay.
It's better now. 20 years ago, it was really intense.
I think it was harder then. I think it was hard. I'm not minimizing anyone's struggle who's listening to this.
It was harder to keep?
Much harder to keep your beard. I would word it the other way. In other words, a bacher then, I only grew up once. If you in the 1980s, for a yeshiva boy, that means you've had a son. Just think about who, those of you who have sons. Now also, okay, that whenever they, it doesn't matter how frum the home is, it's healthy for every teenager to individuate themselves. They have to individuate themselves, and that would mean, I remember one year, my whole class, we questioned everything, which is so healthy. A Yiddishkeit, how do you know there's God? How do you know there's the Torah? We didn't question it. This is my journey. It was a whole class in a rebellious way, but it was, I think, the greatest year. And you almost become a Baal Tshuva. No, it's healthy for you to choose it. And many people, when they go through this process, when they re-choose it, let me go to the beard, being that there are many halachic authorities that allow a person to shave, never with a knife, but the Chasam Sofer, you have big halachic, you have big people that they shave their beards with a machine. So it would make rational sense for someone to say, listen, why do I have to be frum in an area that's so hard when it's maybe not that important, according to some opinions, in within the framework. There is a Mesidus Nefesh to that until today. And I'm answering the question. And therefore, anything that represents Mesidus Nefesh, ironically, is something that people do not want to let go of. People are proud of it. Mom is proud of it. That I had this. This is almost like a badge of honor. And I would say the same thing is for women, for shaitels. I don't care how beautiful the shaitel is. You can spend today the $14,000. You're only fooling yourself if you think that what you're wearing doesn't look like a sheitel, and it's a badge of honor. It's the biggest. I know it's the Mesiras Nefesh, and it's the badge of honor that a person in 2025 can go through life. And
but isn't it a Chabad thing, the beer? It's a Chabad Hasidic thing, but Spartan, or same thing with Tuchel and Shekel.
Okay. I'm not gonna. The word minig is wrong. Minig is wrong. I would say there are two steps here. We're not allowed to. Okay, we'll speak about a beard. We're not allowed to. We're not allowed to shave. A man is not allowed to shave his face with a razor. That's a pasuk in the Torah. And then the Torah commands a man and a woman not to cross dress. That's a big deal. And the meaning of cross dressing, according to many, which is a biblical commandment, God tells a man, don't wear the garments of a lady, and a woman should not wear. According to the Tzemach Tzedek, aside of the fact that he was a Rebbe, he was a big halachic authority. He wrote that even trimming is called cross dressing. One thing is clear that you see in the world right now, and we should be afraid for our kids and for our grandkids, is that once we permitted this unisex garb and the cross dressing, look at the world right now. Look how many people that you know the faces of teenage girls now that are this close to physically mutilating their bodies or doing certain things that will make sure they can, God forbid, never have kids, all because of the cross dressing. It's one of these things that it doesn't make sense. Like, how can it be that bad? It becomes that bad, and there's no limit. And where do you put the line? One opinion is you put the line by a man, wear a beard. That's it. You're not a woman, you're a man. Nekuda. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, when they came out with shavers, I don't know what year that was, I'm talking about machine shavers, there was a big halachic discussion whether it's permitted or prohibited. I can say that the minority opinion is that you can shave. It's a minority halachic opinion. The majority opinion is that you can trim. That as long as you're a man, I'm talking about a man, as long as men leave their facial hairs, they don't cut it down all the way to their skin, then they are allowed to trim. I would say that will be the consensus. And even if it was trimming, Mesiras Nefesh, I'm not saying that even better to leave the beard, not to touch it. But I'm saying for the Jews in Russia, maybe if a person trimmed, he would get away with something. When you didn't touch it, it's like you're saying, I am Jewish. And today we're living in a society that everyone is doing it. I love to be Jewish. We are living in Stalin. I would say you're saying Dafka. I agree with what you said. You say it was Dafka. Dafka means I'm even to pay with my life. Because it was a religious war. I think there are times you have to be very careful. It shouldn't be the ego. If the ego says dafka, we're hurting ourselves. We all have that. Yeah, like dafka.
Like I see these people that wear Magen David in a place like, no, you should actually cover it. Or like, I'm just saying, because right now Magen David became a thing.
I like your example. So like this, every person knows themselves. Most of us have a part of themselves to be an unhealthy ego, and the unhealthy ego is dafka. Dafka meaning I'm getting my way. If it's coming from the ego, it's not good, not kosher. If it's coming from God's ego, nothing holier.
And where's the line? Like, let's say you are in like danger, like Paris right now, there's a lot of anti-Semitic Muslim, like you dafka gonna wear your kippah, or just like
I would externalize my Yiddishkeit because the Rebbe was of that opinion. And if it's coming from my dafka, then I'm being very foolish.
The opposite I'm saying. Would you not wear a yarmulke? Would you wear a hat instead?
I would do that which looks the most Jewish, because that was the Rebbe's opinion.
Like walking down.
And I did that. I practiced. Yeah. I would do that. And
Me too, but then I hear you're naive.
Okay. That's their opinion. That's why I'm deferring back to the Rebbe. I think in these issues, you have to have someone who's a tzaddik, who gives direction. Because what's my doubt? My doubt is that by the letter of the law, a person can shave their beard to save their life. They are allowed to do that by the letter, not with even with a knife if they have to, for sure with a machine. On the other hand,
they didn't.
But that was a holy thing. It was a holy thing because that was the approach of holy people, beginning with the Friedrich and Rebbe. That was their approach. Dafka. But not the ego dafka, the neshama dafka. How do I know? I don't know. I would not know if it's coming from my ego or from I would not know. The Rebbe would know. So when the Rebbe says this is the way, Hasidim followed. So they're bandaged up and they are in an airplane. And if anyone would just say boo to them from their response, they would be caught right away. We didn't speak. It didn't fit. All of the money that we used from Hanan and the other Hasidim that had a few, that people gave everything away to go.
How many people was it?
Hundreds of families.
How did they all go on
that plane? They didn't go on that plane. That was just two families. And that costed a lot of money, but we ended up taking, I want to finish, it's a beautiful story. Every family has their story. But the money went to bribe officials. In other words, you bought a ticket. You needed to bribe people. They shouldn't call their supervisors. The people standing in the train stations were not looking for the religious Jew, but there was a branch of the FBI of Russia that their goal was to uproot religious Judaism, not by you leaving. You would think, let them go. No, by getting you and torturing you and killing you, it was a deshoyim. It was anti-Jewish. This Nissen Nemenov, so first of all, God made a miracle that it was very turbulent. And people were vomiting the whole time on that flight. So first of all, that helped. He's in the middle of the flight, when they're flying from one city in Russia to the other. It was time to daven Shachris. And he stood up on the airplane and he put on his talis and he put on his tefillin and he davened. And where do you find such people? I'm talking about, this is lechatchila ribet or crazy. This is so lechatchila ribet, and that's how they survived. Now, once they got out, so the general path was that Jews would go. First of all, we went to the Kazakh, to the Tans. We went to Samarkand, was a big hub. Many people were there for a long time. It was under the Soviet Union, but all of the Tans are Muslim countries, so they were not so anti-Semitic. This is before the State of Israel was established. That changed everything vis-a-vis how Muslims view Jews. But once you left Russia, so many people, many Hasidim were in Samarkand for a long time. But at some point, they would go to Poland. This was the derech. And from Poland, they would go to Western Europe, whether they went to Vienna, or whether they went to Germany. And from there, once you were in Western Poland, then you were in the free world. Then the Friedrich Rebbe would tell every family where they should go to.
So they left Germany before the war?
No, this is after the war. Well, it's 1946. The big exodus of Chabad Hasidim, to my knowledge, I mean, people left the whole time, was when Stalin was still alive. Stalin died in 1953. When he died, I'm not saying things were good, but the cruelty, the worst, was in the 40s and the beginning of the 50s. Mamas, Jews were arrested and they were killed. Mumasada, they murdered her. Why? Mamas. That was her crime. I mean, her crime was that she was frum. Sometime, at some point during this, these big trains filled with Lubavitcher Hasidim, the Friedrich Rebbe's daughter went into her father's office because he was supposed to come out to a meal. So he was in his office. She went to opened up the door, and he looked like he's not here. And she felt that either he had a heart attack or he had a stroke, and her reaction was hysterical right away. Something was wrong. Now, the Friedrich Rebbe, I'm sure, many times went off in his thoughts. Something was different. And she began to shout. The Rebbe has an office downstairs. The Rebbe's current, we all went to the Rebbe's office. He had a merit to walk in. The Rebbe, from the beginning, that was his place. When the Rebbe came here in 1941, that was his apartment. That room has a little bathroom. The Rebbe and the Rebbetzin lived there. And then the Rebbetzin would go spend her day upstairs with her mother, and he made his bedroom, his home, into his office, in which Rabbi Chadikov would go into. And eventually the Rebbe moved out to President Street. I don't know how many months, it was within the year, but that if that, and then it became his Yechidus room. And then when the Rebbetzin, when his wife, when our Rebbetzin passed away, the Rebbe moved back in there. And the Rebbe was in his office, he heard his sister-in-law shouting. He ran upstairs. He opened the door, he took a look at the Friedrich Rebbe. The Rebbe knew right away it's not a bad thing. He knew the Friedrich Rebbe went someplace spiritually. So right away calmed her down. But the Rebbe wanted to know, the Rebbe shared what happened. He wanted to know, where is he? So he decided to go near him. And when the Rebbe came near the Friedrich Rebbe, he noticed that he's shuffling his feet. Friedrich Rebbe was paralyzed, but he's moving his feet. Imagine when you're sitting and you're moving your feet back and forth. And he heard him say, Shiras Hayam. He was saying again and again, Oz Gavaldik. And that was the time that you had hundreds of Hasidim on these trains, wow, on false passports. And he was, who knows in what place in over there, davening that the Hasidim should make it out. So that was the whole thing. Mama was completely off my topic, but that was it's a good.
It's like so connected.
Yeah, everything is connected. But this is this is us. This is Lubavitch. So what I just wanted to bring a little stickle of the story, and there's so much more to these stories. There are books. There's a book called Samarkand that people can buy and read.
I have it in Hebrew.
It's Gavaldik to read these stories. I have just to share one memory that my mother shared with me that she has, they also left like this, but they were in Samarkand. I don't know for how long. My mother has a cousin, first cousin. One of these stories that both of the parents were arrested, the Rishayim, from the KGB. And once the kids are without parents, then legally the government puts them in an orphanage. So they had one daughter. So my Zayda and Baba right away adopted her, all legally. Her name was Shulamis. And so they grew up like sisters. And my mother says that when they were leaving Samarkand, beginning their journey of leaving Russia, this was a dangerous trek, the first leg was on a horse and a wagon. And they were in a wagon. And it wasn't these fancy wagons. She remembers her and Shulamis sitting in the back of the wagon. I think she was 8 years old. She remembers the way she was sitting, she was describing. And as they're going out of their village, someone came running after the wagon, which was amazing. That her father, Shulamis' father, was just released. And the first thing he says is that he wants his daughter back. And she remembers the joy that she felt. It was like a sister. That her father, she has a father. And the pain that she lost her sister. And everything was risky. Because they were taking a risk. If they would get caught, who knows what would happen to them. Leaving them behind is vital to risk. Anyway, she was left behind. And she married Rabbi Vosner. Rabbi Chaim Vosner is now one of the biggest Rabbanim in the world. His father had a yeshiva called Chachmei Lubina B'nei Brak. Rabbi Vosner, he passed away when he was 101. This Rabbi Vosner, like unbelievable, this Rabbi...
Not Chabad.
Almost anti-Chabad. Almost anti-Chabad. It turned out that because of this connection that my mother had with her, during the years that people, from their ignorance, to give them credit, they all passed away when they were fighting against the Rebbe. So Rabbi Vosner was very against Chabad. One of the ways of containing was through my mother with his daughter-in-law, because the old Rabbi Vosner, he had, I think, 14 kids. His prize child, prize meaning his successor, is Rab Chaim, who's a giant. He was the Satmar Rav in England, I think, for 20 years. And after his father passed away, Shmuel Halevi, the original Rabbi Vosner, his story is also beautiful stories. The story is that there was a young woman in Vienna who was gifted with a voice that was one in a generation, an unbelievable voice. And someone heard her sing. And word got around that this is like a talent. And they came from the opera of Vienna to this Fruma woman to tell her to come join. They'll teach her how to sing and she'll become this famous singer. And she wanted to go and become a singer. And in America, thank God, I'm not talking about the detail about a woman singing, but Bachal, in America, it doesn't matter what position you hold, you can be Frum. That's now. wasn't that way. If you belong to that world of the arts, there was no way you're going to be from. Even here, people should be careful. The people that get involved in the world of Hollywood, people have to have a koyach to stay. But there's a lot of freedom here. And
we're going to listen to the rest on the
recording. Sure, sure. Some just what happened with her was is that the mother, I forgot her name, she wanted to join the opera, and her father didn't know what to do with himself. So he tried to talk her out of it. It wasn't going. And finally they met, final attempt, they met this big Rebbe. I forgot which Rebbe it was. One Rebbe came to vacation in Vienna from Eastern Europe. And the Rebbe asked her, what are you looking for? Like, what's behind this desire? So she says that she wants to leave a mark in this world. And that tzaddik told her that if you'll opt not to go to that environment, you will be blessed with a child. That was a bracha that he gave her that will make leave a mark in this world. There's another part of the story. The other part of the story is, anyways, maybe I'm mixing up two stories. There's another story, maybe that's the story, that there were two neighbors and they were sharing the hanging line for the dryer. Not the American dryers with the machine, the clothesline. And they would take turns, and a woman went ahead, and I think that was a mice. Maybe this, I forgot.
What did she do?
Is that when it was her day to use the line, the neighbor thought that it wasn't. And from anger, she took all of her clothing and she threw it in the mud. She threw it down. And she didn't say a word. She didn't share it with her husband because she knew that her husband will have an issue with that guy's husband. She was quiet. And when it was discovered that the mistake was made and she didn't vent, someone gave her a bracha. So either this or that. Wow. Anyways, this Jew lived until 106.
The
Shmuel Ali, he became a non-Chabad giant halachic authority. Giant. And now his kid, so his kid married Shulamis. Wow. And every Lubavitch of goes down. Every Lubavitch of family from Russia has a miracle that was very risky, and it wasn't today one trip. It wasn't a 6-hour nervous trip. It was a few weeks. And in every phase, you can get caught. And every time you come to the border, I think until now, many of us, when I come to a passport control, I get anxious. Why do I get anxious?
Generational trauma.
This is because during those years, whether you were a Jew in Western Europe, whether you were a Russian in Eastern Europe, you were in trouble because you're Jewish. You just can't be you. You can be anything but not nishdir. So all of this, I'm going to come back, is that Hasidim had a lot of guts and lachatchila liber. So that's one mode of being. Coming back to the beginning of the class, the other mode of being is don't be such a big thinker, don't be such a big doer, don't take a bite. There's so many expressions. Don't take a bite bigger than you can handle. Be methodical, be mesuder, go step by step. And how do you know which one to do? That is how we began the class. How do you know when you're facing something in life, should this be a problem that you tackle? Go buy your first class ticket and go daven on the plane and lay in their face. Even what you're asking, should I? So take it easy. Be more organized, be more thoughtful, be more conservative, be more careful. And even if you can't get a lot, tofasta meruba loy tofasta, tofasta meuta tofasta. And these two mindsets are always at war, which is a good thing, and we should be more aware of this challenge. And how do we begin to attempt to resolve it?
It's just personal.
Everything is personal.
Right.
And if it wouldn't be personal, then this whole conversation is not worth anything. No, there has to be, in other words, an idea. In yeshiva, we can just talk about ideas, even if it's not personal. No, people learn Torah. Torah has to be personal. And yeah, it's in everything in our lives, mamish, and the way we interact with our kids, and outwards, there's always lechatchila riber, just do it, or why should I risk it all? I'll do a little piece at a time, and it might work, it might not work. But at least if it doesn't work, I'm not going to bring the house down.
What's a river? What does that mean?
Lachatchila Iber.
I know
what Lachatchila Iber means over.
Oh, over.
Why? You know, it's the world says, yeah, when you come to a problem, try to deal with it. If you can deal with it, then go over. The Rebbe Marash says, why should you even try to deal with it? Lechatchila Iber.
And what's the opposite called?
See, there's no expression as good as Lechatchila Iber. I'm calling it in the Maimer that I would like to share. It's called, the Maimer is dealing with how do you get rid of something negative, yeah, a little bit at a time.
Yeah.
A little bit of time means don't go for gold. Ma'at, 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 ma'at. Many people, when the Rebbe had that Machne Yisrael fund, which you look back, how much they wanted, you needed to commit to $100,000. This is in the middle of 80s. It was a lot of money, but paid out over 5 years, $20,000 a year. And that gave you twice a year a semi-private audience with the Rebbe, which was something that was, everyone wanted that. And a lot of these audiences were filmed for right or wrong. This is all that Rebbe agreed to it, because a lot of what was brought up was personal. In Brazil at that time, there was a person, like almost everyone in the 80s, that the businesses were not 100% kosher. Let me just explain, we're Americans. Here in America, people have kosher businesses. A non-kosher business here would mean, let's say, a drug business. That's not what it meant in Brazil. A non-kosher business always had to do with taxes. Is that the government created a system. It's a system of corruption where the government officials cannot live off their salaries. So how do they make a living? Almost every part of government life is set up in a way where people cannot keep the law. In order to give the police the power to catch you and for him to get a bribe. So a policeman, when I grew up, was earning $300 a month. Well, you can't live off $300. You don't need the American money. But how did they make a living? They would pull you over speeding, and you would bribe them. Remember, I was driving a car with my father. My father never had a license. Never got a Brazilian license. And he's speeding. I remember I was so nervous. I think I was 17. And a cop pulls him over. And he says, let's change places. I said, Todd, the cop is behind us. Like when you park, change places. So can you imagine the chutzpah? So I change places with, I sit in the driver's seat. And the cop goes to my father, to the past, and he says, license. He says, am I in the driver's seat? Avraham Meir, can you show him your license? So I'm thinking, what is this man doing? But I was a yeshiva boy. I didn't understand. That's how it works there. So first of all, they acknowledge the police. He says, you can't do this. You don't have a license, right? My father says, I don't have a license, but am I in the driver's seat? So then you begin with that. Then the first thing the guy says that I want you to know. He says that they always have a story that I have a daughter and she has an illness and says, tzaddis. Oof, so my father was such a good listener. So you listen, you ask details, all of the tzaddis. Then my father tells him that's not chutzpah of my father. Normally he wants money. My father tells him, listen, that I make curtains. He made curtains. And he says, here's my, he gave him his business card and he trusted my father. He says, you come to my factory and I'll get curtains for your whole house. It means my father didn't even pay him money. That's how corrupt it is. And the guy was fine with it because the whole system is corruption. So people had businesses that didn't pay tax. They didn't do that. Even if you pay tax, they would catch you. So you might as well not pay the tax. And when they come, the IRS comes. The whole thing is a negotiation of how you're going to. It's crazy. So why am I saying all of the story for?
You're living your life in fear.
Huh?
You're always living your life in fear, though.
Yeah. Well, but you get away with it because until when you didn't. Yeah, it was different. There's a Milo that if you have money, you'll get away with it. I'm just saying, lachatchila ribet. I don't know if I was coming from there. Lachatchila chutzpah. Okay, so when do you do what? And the Alter Rebbe has a very wise. I mean, if I would have been an hour ago, I would have had more time to speak about it. It's 5 minutes. Let me give you one mashal he gives. I think it's a great example. This mashal, it got me. Let's say that joy is a lechatchila ribirdike feeling. Joy, it's very intoxicating, real simcha. And, you know, there's joy that you could contain. And sometimes things are so joyful that they just explode out. and you're going to be smiling, you're going to be laughing, you're going to be dancing, like mamish, uncontained joy. People are able, some people, are able to be there without earning it. The mashal he gives is that you walk into a home and there's a lot of cruelty in the home, but the parents are very happy. I would even say that some people that are victims of a lot of cruelty, their escape is to be happy. Sometimes they need a drug to get there, but it's not about the drug. It's about you can be in a very celebratory emotional space, unearned. That is klipa. And earned joy is very powerful.
What's an earned joy?
So let me just apply it to Yitzias Mitzrayim. That when we left Egypt, there was a quicker route to go into Israel. Let's say Israel is this lechatchila riberdeke mindset. In this context, a very elevated place to be, very courageous, very l'chatchila river. And the desert, to survive in the desert, you have to exercise a lot. You have to make a lot of effort, you have to have a lot of discipline, you have to have a lot of wisdom. I'm not talking about the fact that there was miracles there, I'm not looking at that part. The long route in order to get to Israel is the Alter Rebbe's way of saying that everyone in their life has to have something that they purposefully do not take the lechatchila aribe route, something that they really work at, for them to earn the joy that we all get when you do the hard work. There's something about, and then you get to expand it to every other place in your life. Alter Rebbe argues that Kedusha is measure. Klipa is limitless.
Klipa means a covering. No?
Klipa means a covering. That's a good mashal. I just thought, when you look at a fruit, you know when klipa is a bad thing? When you think all there is the klipa. Or let me say better, if all there is the covering, then klipa is bad. If all there is only the shell, but there's no content, then klipa is something bad. If there is a good fruit inside, and the klipa is there covering and protecting it, even the better. You have the fruit, and you have the protection. The limitless, we all have within us limitless. We're infinite. It's crazy. We all have within us infinity. We all have within us superpower, all of us. And we all have within us a lot of limitations, a lot of limitations. When do you get to plug into your limitless power? When you plug into your limit. Any person that works on them having more earned content, which would mean it's going to be limited and less because it has to be earned, will be allowed to have in all other areas of their life,
l'chatchila riber. Can you give an example of
that? My example would be his example of laughter. When you have a person that's always laughing, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Could be they're hiding pain.
That for sure. But let's say they're not hiding pain. They're just happy.
It's annoying.
Shake them already. I know we always so funny.
Yeah.
It seems fake.
Yeah. If there was something in your life from which you have genuine laughter, genuine means laughter with content, laughter because you earned it, because the joy that you feel when you set aside for yourself a goal that was difficult to get to and you worked at it, no one, you did it, so to say, and you got there. If you have a moment of that feeling, then you will use for other areas in your life as well. That feeling is what I'm calling lechatchila riber. A feeling of, I overcame. I'm free. I'm free. Freedom. So what is freedom? What's the feeling of freedom? I would say that the well, let me word it like this. The deepest feeling of freedom is me knowing that if I decided to do something, nothing within me will stop me from doing it. Versus the old freedom, like no one without me will stop me. I'm not talking about that. That's Mitzrayim. I'm talking about for the ultimate redemption. And I know that many people are still stuck in areas where they would like to do something important, but there are outside forces that are stopping. I'm not talking. My problem is me. I'm my biggest pari. I decided to do this discipline, and I can't keep to it, so I'm not free. When I find freedom in one little area, I'm not going to conquer the whole world. If I can like make one achlata that's little and stick to it, that will give me a earned joy. That will give me a earned feeling of I overcame, aribir. And then I take that and I apply it to other areas in my life.
Confidence?
You want to use the word confidence. Yeah. Very good. I have confidence comes from lechatchil aribir. And self-doubt, just for the record, confidence is amazing at the right time. Self-doubt is also amazing at the right time. Because if I wouldn't have self-doubt, I would be the most arrogant person in the world. Self-doubt, the right way. Like, again, which one should you have? Well, take one area, have a lot of self-doubt, constantly question yourself, schwitz it out, limit yourself, question yourself, and then you will come to confidence. Now that you have confidence that has within it content, then you can apply that. You have the right to apply it even in areas where you didn't earn it yet. But there has to be some work to get to it.
I'm a little bit confused the difference between lechatchila aribir and going slowly, because it seems to me that for these people to go and buy these tickets and to get on an airplane was like, first of all, very thought out.
Actually, it wasn't thought out. I want to tell you, it was when they found out in that story, they found out that the police are after them, they needed to make choices very quick.
Right, sounds impulsive.
It wasn't thought out.
But if you're pushed into something, if you're really pushed where you don't have a choice anymore, then that's pretty decisive. It's not like an impulsive.
You can argue. I mean, they did the right thing, and God saved them. That the safer route would have been safer. Take a train. Everyone did that. No one flew. They did something that no one did.
Maybe they thought it was safer. Maybe they just thought this is safer.
Or they didn't think.
No. They thought this is safe, but it was based on a big mindset.
Like arrogance?
No, big.
For the purpose of like saying like here we are, like you can't stop us, or
by thinking that that part of the KGB will not be placed in the airport because
that's just smart. I don't think that's necessarily lechatchila.
So then I correct my story. It's a great story. Like, could be, you're right. Not could be. I take what you're saying.
Like to me, lechatchila river is like, just get on the train, whatever happens, happens.
Like belief.
Okay, let me, I know it's late. Rabbi Shlomo Kunin, for people, whatever your opinion is, he is lechatchila river. The Rebbe spoke about it. In the 1980s, he was the only shliach that owed $10 million, $18 million. Like, that's lechatchila river. And the Rebbe spoke about it in public. The Rebbe spoke about him at the very rear. That it's too much. Whatever happened until now, God will help.
That's too much.
His recklessness is lechatchila river. Of we're doing the Rebbe's work, and we're going to borrow and borrow and borrow and borrow, and we're doing the right thing, which is what every Fruma family does over here. It's all lechatchila river. The whole life in LA is lechatchila river, but there's in lechatchila river, like some people do it better than others. And he never gave up, and the Rebbe criticized him, and then he went up to a lottery, or the person died, or whatever it was, and he right away got into the same debt again. It took him just a few years to be back on the same place. Huh?
Personality.
I want to give him some credit. I think it's also Mesiras Nefesh. it was that the cause was so important for him that he couldn't, like he's giving it all. However, maybe that's a better mashal for lachat chibus, because that was not thought out. When you have a business and you begin to earn a few dollars, most people won't go from selling $1 million a year, you want to go to selling $1 billion a year, you're not ready for it. It's too big of a jump. The chatchila adib are people that don't limit themselves. And the Alter Rebbe is explaining that everyone has to have an area in life where they self-impose limits, where they do things methodically. And then whatever they get to, the end is joy, the end is accomplishment, the end is confidence, it's earned. It's not only klipa. Not fake it until you make it. Make it. But once you make it, now take that. You have to earn the license for lechatchila river. How do you earn it? How long do you have to suffer? He doesn't write that. How do we apply it? But he definitely makes the point that you can't, in everything in life, say lechatchila river. Lechatchila river would have been leaving Egypt and going to Israel. And God says, not going to work that way. That yeah, you got rid of Egypt. But for you to earn the Holy Land, you have to earn it. You have to work on it. You have to journey to Israel.
But lechatchila river is not being like foolish, right? Because like going from a million to a billion, no business can sustain it. It could be going from a million to like 5 million, where most people, right?
That's what I meant.
It's not where you're being. That's like, what I careless.
Meant. In actuality, everyone applies this another way.
Oh, and klipa, were you referring to that as a, like, klipa is usually like klipa, not a good thing.
Klipa is not holy. Holy is order.
Okay.
And chaos generally is klipa. Okay. And then there was a concept of holy chaos. And holy chaos has to be earned. Holy chaos can be embarked on a person that already did some work with order.
Right. You need kalim, basically.
Like, you need to have some kalim, somewhere, epis kalim.
Yeah.
You can't have no kalim.
And you can't have a chachila river in a non-klipitic way unless you have some kalim.
In your life, that's what the Alter Rebbe is saying in this maimed, according to my understanding of this maimed. You have to have tikkun, and then from tikkun you go to toyu. You can't go straight into toyu. You can't leave Egypt and go into Israel. You can't do that.
And the klipa in this story is where? Once you're there?
The klipa in the story the Alter Rebbe gives is that a house filled with laughter is a good thing or a bad thing. Mm-hmm. It depends. If there is content to the laughter, if the laughter is coming because there is a lot of good things happening in the house, that laughter is great. If there is nothing good happening and people are choosing, I'm going to be happy. That's klipa.
Okay, I got it now.
Lechatchila ribir, without work, that's the whole point, is the same, make the same face. It's not nisht. Now, it doesn't mean that lechatchila ribir, in Lubavitch, lechatchila ribir is the main. And the hard work is a little, fine. I'm not talking in quantity, in the concept.
Right,
we have to have something in my life that's not lechatchila ribir. I would even say that learning Torah, there's no lechatchila ribir in Torah. Because learning, you have to learn. You want to learn Hilcha Shabbos, you got to learn it. There's no lechatchila ribir. Or pick any other, pick a parting in life in which you subject yourself to hard work.
Starting a business.
And you celebrate, every little win. Get joy from the limited incremental growth. And if you have that, then you are allowed to have lechatchila ribir, dika moments in your life in which you just lechatchila, you go to the goal without any hard work.
Is leaving Mitzrayim in a haste the same way as they left in a haste, like a lechatchila ribir that comes from?
No. Leaving Mitzrayim in a haste, Alter Rebbe explains, is that when people are very weak, if I'm very weak towards chocolate, then I should run away from an environment that has chocolate. And when I become more mature, I should be able to sit with chocolate and tell the chocolate, I want you, you're amazing, I'm not having you, and I'll do it.
But they were chasing us.
The chocolate chases the guy. The people that break their diets, they say, I ran away from the food. The food been running after me. And you have to get older. And it's about spiritual maturity. So when people, I have to know myself. If I know that I'm still weak, So don't behave like this courageous person. Run away from it. But that's a pathetic place to be. The ideal will be is I want to grow up to be able to have the freedom of being able to say no without running away from it. Now, can I do it? Well, the proof is in the pudding. Are you doing it? No one can fool themselves. That struggle and the success, incremental success, is something needed in our lives. And if I have that, then I'm allowed to indulge in lechatchila river dikah moments in my life. And you're right. In this story, there was no real option. But it takes people to also have lechatchila river to know how to do it. Most people don't know how to do that. Lubavitch teaches us lechatchila river, amazing. I can speak for the boys. Our boys, just going on mifzayim, develop certain muscles that no other group gives to the kids. A Lubavitcher boy has the courage to somehow go into the office of the CEO to get him to put on tefillin. And by the way, that gives him the courage later when he goes into the world to be able to become very successful if God wants, because there's a certain amount of lechatchila riber dika attitude. So lechatchila riber, just for the record, is something that we celebrate. This maimer is almost the opposite of it, is to remember that there is another way, and you have to have both. You can't only have one. Then everything becomes too big, too quick, too unearned. You just end up with one big shell. You walk around with a big smile plastered on your face, but there's no content. And incremental growth is talking very little, but there's this unique joy that you earned, like confidence. That's why people get confidence when they face what they are bad at and they do it. And they won't do it easily. There's no other way to get confidence. Mamish, there's no shortcut. You have kids want confidence. You can speak up your kids until you're blue in your face. It will not work. They'll have to constantly come back to you. You're making them dependent. For them to get confidence, they have to struggle with that which is hard for them. And they won't go lechatchila river. They don't know how to do it. Then they earned the ticket to lechatchila river. The desert is the hard work. Yamsuf represents the ocean and the splitting of the ocean. You have to have both. Good.